From the studios of Wavefront Audio Visual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 116 of Little Brother for the 28th of January, 2023. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com, or you can post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started. UK Authority is reporting that the schools in the UK are at a high risk of cyber attacks. Two education bodies, the London Grid for Learning and the National Cybersecurity Centre, conducted an audit, and the findings are not good. Of the 432 schools surveyed, 78% of them had weathered some sort of cyber attack in the last year, including ransomware, data loss, loss of access, email impersonation, and some schools even reported parents losing money due to a cyber attack on a school. Tiemann is a technology company that makes surveillance systems for apartment buildings. Recently, according to an article in Vice, they have been making a pitch at landlords in New York City and other places with rent-controlled apartments to provide the means to give tenants an effective digital proctology exam. The automated products look for lease violations, however large or small, that landlords can use to evict tenants and break the lease, thereby allowing them to free the apartment from the controlled rent. Look out, Big Brother is watching you, and I'm watching him. Ars Technica is reporting that appliance makers are so sad that appliance owners aren't connecting their smart appliances to the internet. Aww. Yes, that was the word they used, sad. Their engineers have gone to all this effort to put smarts into your appliance and give it a way to talk to the world. Roughly 80 to 90% of appliances sold are smart appliances, and it appears that less than half of them are getting the connection to show off their smarts. Well, I'm going to tell you that I'm one of the appliance owners who is making the makers sad. My reasoning is simple. My washing machine has no need to communicate to get its job done. I give it power, I give it water, I give it soap and its softener, and it washes my clothes. End of transaction. Why do I bring this up now? Well, apparently some smart appliances are getting bored. PC Magazine is reporting that security researcher Stefan von Ruhe got curious and looked to see what his AEG smart oven was talking to. As it turns out, every 5 minutes or so, it did connectivity tests, connecting it to sites in the US, Russia, and China. While the intent is probably innocuous, it does provide an attack surface in places in the world that are somewhat less than perfectly friendly. Optical discs have been with us for several technological generations now, from the laser disc to the compact disc, the video CD, super video CD, DVD, and Blu-ray disc, plus a handful of evolutionary dead ends, such as the HD DVD. We may be nearing the end of the optical disc era, however, as Japanese tech giant Panasonic have announced that they are ceasing production of recordable Blu-ray discs next month. Sales of blank recordable media have been falling off sharply, and the company says it has become difficult to secure profits. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Well, here we are again. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned This Week. We have two this week. First up, we have an own goal shot by the Green Party of Canada. It seems as though the political party violated its own internal rules and posted lists of its membership with names, phone numbers, addresses, etc., the usual contact info, of tens of thousands of registered members and voters, to a public-facing website. Credit card and financial information appears not to have been part of the breach, however, but enough information was leaked to make fraud fairly easy to perpetrate. However, there is a more interesting one. The U.S. has, for a couple of decades now, maintained a list of people, commonly known as the no-fly list, who are, go figure, not allowed to board an aircraft. There's been a lot of discussion in civil liberties circles about this list, because there's no real way to find out if you are on it, except to try to fly. No authority really to appeal to about it, except that maybe you can prove that you're not that James Smith. And there has long been a suspicion about who all might be on the list. Well, all of that just changed. It goes without saying that airlines need access to this list. If they didn't have access to it, how would they know not to let somebody who is on it fly? Well, it seems as though one airline, Commute Air, put the list on an improperly secured development server and a Swiss hacker known as Maya Arson snagged a copy. This is why you don't use production data on a development server and why you don't put development servers where they can be breached from the outside. But I think in this case, I'm glad they screwed up. A recent discussion with some of the others in the local hacking scene raised an interesting question. It started when somebody made a reference to decoding a key. Now, I should be clear here, the key in question, the one hypothetically being decoded, isn't some encryption key or unlock code. No, it's an actual key of the kind that you plug into a mechanical lock and turn to open a door or start a car. Well, you used to use them to start a car, etc. So, in a nutshell, the critical piece of information about a key is what is called the bitting. This is the pattern of ridges along the one side of the key that raises the key pins into their correct positions so that the shear lines all line up and you can turn the key. About 8 years ago, a newspaper published a picture of the seven keys that the TSA uses to open approved luggage locks. From that picture, some security researchers were able to make estimates of what the bidding was on the keys, and from that, they were able to produce 3D printed copies of the keys, and they worked. For this, the math was done by hand. During the discussion with the group locally about decoding a key and what it meant, one member pointed us all to an interesting project in GitHub. It was posted by Maxime Bias, co-authored by Quentin Clement, and is called, fittingly, Key Decoder. Key Decoder is a mobile app that, using just a photograph of a key, will tell you what the bidding on that key is and enable you to create a pristine copy of it. Bottom line, don't let anyone photograph your keys. There's been some talk lately about a BBC documentary called India, the Modi Question. It's a two-part series that's highly critical of India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Now, as I've said before, I don't want this podcast to be about politics, but here is a spot where politics and technology intersect. For those who do not follow international politics, I'll just say that it tells you a lot about Modi to know that, as of this recording, police in India have been detaining college students for the crime of gathering to watch this series. India may be the world's largest democracy, but this does kind of make it look like its democracy is somewhat on the skids. Anyway, BBC tries to keep a fairly short leash on its content. They enforce their copyrights pretty vigorously in ways that public media in other countries really don't. There's reasons for this that I won't get into, but for the moment, let's just keep that in mind. At the same time, the Internet Archive tries very hard to hold for public consumption, well, everything, really, but especially things of civic importance, such as a documentary about a world leader, especially one who may trend authoritarian. And here we have a collision. There was a bit of an uproar when the news came out that the Internet Archive would be removing the documentary from its systems. This broke the internet as rumors about why gave way to stories of outrage that the Indian government would demand such a thing of an American organization such as the Internet Archive, or that the Internet Archive would acquiesce to the Indian demands on the topic. The Streisand effect kicked in. For those not familiar with the Streisand effect, this is named for Barbara Streisand, who tried in vain to get photographs of her home removed from the internet, only to cause interest in those photos to explode. The mistaken belief on the part of the public that Modi had demanded that the Internet Archive remove the series only blasted interest in it through the roof, engaging people who otherwise wouldn't have even given the series a second thought. Well, it does turn out that the rumors were wrong. BBC were actually the ones who asked for the files to be removed from the archive, claiming copyright, which the Internet Archive honored. But at this point, the damage is done. BBC couldn't have done a better job of guerrilla marketing of this documentary if they had tried. New copies of it are spread far and wide, and more importantly, folks in India who want to see it probably can. Piracy is a thing. I'm not going to talk about the morality or the legality of it here, at least not in this episode, but I think we can all take it as read that folks who pirate software, music, TV shows, movies, even books, walk among us, and I would not be the least bit surprised to find that it happens among my listenership. Piracy happens. I don't care a whole lot about the economic impact of it. I just don't. I've watched things evolve since the 1980s, where efforts to combat piracy over and over only ended up impacting folks who were trying to get their content by legitimate means, and quite bluntly, my patience and sympathy have worn thin. But who makes piracy possible? It's got a dark side, you know. I recently attended a webinar put on by WatchGuard, and I was stunned to learn that there are commercial applications for downloading content from YouTube. The main reason I found this stunning is that there are some great free options out there, by which I mean both free as in speech, such as the open source YTDLP, or free as in beer, such as the freeware video download helper. Now, just an aside here, I suspect very strongly that Google would take an issue with you downloading videos from YouTube. I've never asked them this question because I really don't care, but doing so does bypass advertising and may also hose up their analytics, so I'm not particularly inclined to believe that they think kindly on it. They may even call it piracy, who knows? Alright, so anyway, someone decided to make some money taking money away from YouTube. Fine. To use it, you need to buy a code that you need to enter. Well, you're already in piracy land here, so of course you just download a crack for the thing, install it, and woohoo! You can download YouTube videos. But at what cost? You see, here's the problem. In downloading that crack, you are getting something sketch from someone sketch to do something sketch with a thing that has a purpose that itself might be sketch. That's like 4 degrees of sketch there. What in the ever-loving fuck are you doing trusting that last person to provide you with a piece of software that you are going to run on your computer? You see, what you didn't see happen was the malware that the guy offering the crack, shall I call him a crack dealer? Nah, probably not. What you didn't see is the malware that came in the package with the crack. This is the perfect opportunity for you, or worse, your organization, thanks to you, to end up featured at the start of one of my episodes when I talk about who got pwned this week. In short, don't download that. You don't know what's in it, who's handled it, where it's been, or what disease it may give your computer. Find another way, preferably one that is open source and hopefully has been seen by a few people to know it's safe. And never, ever needs a crack. As usual, we'll end this week's episode with the fail of the week. There is no cloud, goes a popular adage, there is just someone else's computer. Many of the services and applications that we use these days rely on resources that are placed in that cloud of other people's computers. Got a Gmail account? That's someone else's computer. Use a popular messaging app? Yep, you're using someone else's computer to connect. This is not an inherently bad thing, but sometimes it misfires, and in all cases, it puts you at someone else's mercy. Not that long ago, places of business, except for maybe some smaller companies, would have a handful of servers that host internal email, messaging, etc. At the time, it made the most business sense because the internet connections were not all that fast, and they needed to be used somewhat sparingly. It meant that using that connection to send an email 2 cubicles over made no sense when you could just send it to a machine in the same building and back. But between then and now, internet connections have gotten faster and cheaper, and things have morphed into a service-based model. Rather than buying hardware and software, you buy a service, you hire a service, and most of the time this works well enough. But that brings us to this week's fail. It goes to Microsoft, by the way, whose cloud service is used not just to provide spare compute and offsite storage, but also to provide services like email, Outlook.com, and messaging, Teams, that used to be hosted on-site. Economically, it makes sense, as maintaining a server has a cost, and Microsoft can take advantage of economics of scale here, until it fails. On Wednesday, Microsoft's cloud platform, known as Azure, suffered a failure that meant that a large number of organizations were not able to access email or to use the Teams messaging platform. To put the importance of that into context, the last several organizations that I have worked for have all used Teams to coordinate work, to replace the desktop telephones that used to grace every cubicle, and to hold virtual meetings. In short, It's how business got conducted. Without it, productivity stopped in many organizations. Microsoft were able to bring it back up in a matter of hours, and of course, they are investigating the cause. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fungaboo and the crowd at Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to David, DOA, Thriller at Play, Fungaboo, and Joe Cadillac for story leads. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Punt music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our Fail of the Week music is Space Reggae by Zap. Our opening theme music and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker. And our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com or post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Stay safe and be well.